3 days ago, I started to feel a kind of an irritation, a lump right here at the back of my neck. And it started getting larger. So I was worried, and I went to the Sisters of Jerusalem to have them take a look at it.
Rate of maturation, 7.3 millimeters per hour.
Per hour? What's your diagnosis?
Her tumor doesn't have any of the usual characteristics of tumorous tissue. What Karen has is a fast-growing swelling made up of flesh and bone. You might almost describe it as a fetus.
On her neck?
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of The Manitou.
Bana Richie Salatu.
Hosted by Arnie.
I'm the best there is, top of the line.
Jacob.
You're the best. You taught me everything I know.
And Stuart.
Professor, if this guy was so powerful, how are we going to fight him?
This podcast is spoiler-filled and contains harsh language.
We are living in a world run by computers and technology. Some creature from 400 years ago is scaring the hell out of us.
Listener discretion is advised.
I think we should begin right away. Douse the lights, please.
Today, we're discussing The Manitou. Starring Tony Curtis, Michael Ansara, Susan Strasberg, Stella Stevens, John Cedar, Ann Southern, and Burgess Meredith, as Dr. Snow, directed by William Girdler. This is Pick a Podcast Arnie. That's me. Arnie's my name. Podcasting's my game.
And Stuart.
And this is the host who's had three wood nymphs, a banshee, and a mermaid, Jacob.
Welcome, February patrons.
Manitou, why are we here, Stuart? We're doing a patron show that was not actually picked by a patron for a change. This one was picked by you.
Yes. Well, again, it's sort of the culmination of a series that we've been involved in for the last several months. When I think of the 70s and Satanic Panic, it does start with Rosemary's Baby. You should probably put The Exorcist in there. We did that one a long time ago. And then, yeah, The Omen was sort of the tail end of it all. But right at the end of the decade, around 1979, there was this crazy little thing that tried to do all of them and Star Wars and maybe Deep Throat. And so I feel like, hey, why don't we work in this one? I will say this. I did not see this movie back in the day.
You didn't see this as a child?
No, no. You know what? Nonsensical titles are a real turnoff, right? Like, if you don't know what a word means, you're probably not going to see the movie about it.
Yeah, it's probably a foreign film. I don't want to watch this.
Or a movie about a killer sea cow, like the manatee or something like that. I didn't know what the Manitou was. And I think that I read somewhere someone mention it as being a spectacular bad movie. And so I brought it to Bad Movie Club. When I was doing that back in LA, I brought it to people that we just like to sit around and watch crazy things. And we were all blown away. And then last year, my brother had a tumor that he had removed. And to cheer him up the night before his surgery, I said, I have the perfect film. And so we watched it again.
Did he have nightmares of a Native American shaman coming out of his neck?
Or maybe fantasies. I don't know. But he really enjoyed the film as well. And so I just feel like it's something that always cheered me up. It's sort of a go-to.
Cheers you up. Okay.
Yes, definitely. Like, I definitely feel like it's a nice compliment to what we were doing with Rosemary and Damien. And so Misquamacus probably deserves to be spoken at least in the same sentence as Pazuzu. If we did Exorcist 2, we probably should cover The Manitou.
Yeah, I had never seen this one, never heard of it. I did watch the trailer before I watched the film, because Stuart, the way you were talking about it, you're like, oh, this film is crazy. I'm like, all right, I got to see what kind of crazy it is. Give me a little flavor. Let me watch this trailer. You know what they spoil in that trailer? Like in the first like 9 seconds? Neck fetus.
Oh.
I'm like, oh, I'm sold. I wish I didn't know that going into the film, but I'm sold.
Yeah, you kind of want to know nothing going in.
I've never even heard of this film, and I didn't watch a trailer before starting it. Stuart had talked about it. I did know I wasn't in for a good time. It was either going to be a bad time or a good bad time, but you talked about this as a bad movie that you love.
So I came in with expectations as such.
Well, are you familiar with author Graham Masterton? This is actually based on a book written by a respected literary master of horror.
I did look him up on Wikipedia. He was also like the editor for UK Penthouse.
Yeah, I was going to get there. I was going to hold back on that. But yes, he's largely endorsed. You'll get little quotes on his books from Stephen King and James Herbert and people with horror cred. And like, yeah, he's thought of, I think, by most circles as a guy who is going to give you a good Lovecraftian tale. But he did start his career writing for Skin magazines and a series of best-selling sex advice books, which I had to pick up. I'm like, okay.
You needed some sex advice? That's why you had to?
Well, I always could use that, but I also wanted to see, like, can I see any of the Manitou in his writing?
Yeah, when you're in a fight to save all reality, stripped down, apparently, is a thing you have to do.
Yes. How to Be a Great Lover is the one I picked up. And I was thinking it was going to be like the Kama Sutra. There would be pictures and positions and, you know, all of that. It's really not that. What he writes about, his stance is how to boost male confidence. He starts off right with some line of BS about how there's no such thing as a bad lover, and then immediately goes into how you can compensate if you have a small penis or you prematurely ejaculate.
Wow.
Well, how do you? I'm asking for a friend.
I can loan him the book if he's interested. But a lot of attention is paid to grooming, what to say and what not to say to girls, just helping you create the impression that if you have confidence, you're going to believe you're a great lover whether you are or not. Maybe you'll never be a good lover. It teaches you nothing about how to actually do the act of sex, but everything in to prepare you so that you think you're going to be awesome when you get into the sack.
So did you put this into the practice? Did it work? Do you think you're a great lover?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. We could do another show about it. Again, I was looking at it from the laser point of view about, like, at what point do they talk about impregnating necks? Like, does that come up?
Where's the spirit of the Xerox machine come into this?
This just sounds like a great exploratory research event for books, nachos, and lube.
Yeah, I maybe. I won't not commit to that series, but just staying on topic, I did end up reading a lot of other things to prepare for this podcast. I wanted to get a flavor for Masterton as a horror writer, but it was interesting to see him start here. He wrote under a pseudonym. He pretended to be a sexy female. And at some point, they blew the lid on that. And the bottom dropped out, too. Sales were really good in the early part of the 70s. But at some point, his publisher told him, you know what? These books aren't selling the way they used to. And so try something else. And what was popular? Satanic Panic. Look at the movies. It was The Exorcist. It was Rosemary's Baby. And so, being a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft, he wanted to see if he could maybe write something in that vein. The Manitou is his first book. That is his stab at it. I did pick up that one as well. And the fun thing about it is, I forget this, but one of the things I love about literature, horror literature of that time, are the paperback covers. Do you guys remember how many books there would be, like, where there'd be the window?
Yes.
And you'd, like, look at the book, and there's, like, the sexy woman, and she's, like, in a window, and you're like, ooh, and you flip open the thing.
Flower in the Attics did it.
Yeah, and then, like, the giant Manitou thing is standing behind her in flames.
Yeah, you open that cover, it's die cut, and it expands on that picture sometimes.
Uh-huh, that's what it had going for it. I mean, I was like, yeah, this cover is something you would pick up to read. In fact, I'm going to give a recommendation. Grady Hendrix, who's a good horror writer in his own right, did a whole, like, nonfiction book called Paperbacks from Hell, where he breaks down almost everything that was published in this style around that time. And it just, I adore that stuff so much. Manitou is a movie because they had that cover, and that paperback was sitting in an airport when director William Girder was passing by on his way to Hollywood, finishing up his movie When Animals Attack. You guys know Girder?
I do not.
He's the most famous director of Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay. I guess I haven't seen a lot of Kentuckian cinema.
This guy did Chiba Baby, the Pam Grier blaxploitation film. Abby, which is apparently, you can't find it, but it is the blaxploitation exorcist. It's so similar that Warner Brothers sued and won on plagiarism charges and now suppresses the film. But people that have seen it say it's really entertaining. Grizzly, It was Jaws with a bear.
I could have guessed that one.
The guy is like, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that they're good, but he cranked like 9 films out in 8 years and died by the time he was 30. Like, it was just this amazingly prolific output.
Like all good auteurs, yeah.
Yeah. So he just chugged it out, and this was at the height of his creative powers. He had just finished Grizzly, Day of the Animals, and he had the money to spend $50,000 on rights for books that he found in the airport and said, I love this cover, read the book, I love this movie, I love this story, and somehow managed to convince Sam Arkoff to cough up $3 million, I think, on the pitch. I think the pitch was it's Exorcist meets Star Wars. He really thought like he could combine those two in a way that audiences would really crave.
Well, who's the producer that got Burgess Meredith? Because they really sell that name. It got me to really pay attention to the credits. As soon as I saw his name, I like had to rewind. I'm like, is he a producer? Like, oh, no, he's in this film.
Special appearance.
Yeah, special appearance.
They woke him up. I think he was in the middle of a dream and he came in and
yes.
He does something there. I'm not sure he was handed a script, but yeah, he has a moment like so many. There's a lot of talent connected to this movie. I mean,
Tony Curtis,
Susan Strasberg, the daughter of the Actors Studio founder, Lee Strasberg. So this woman is going to be one of the greatest actresses you've ever seen before in a movie.
And the voice of Mother from Psycho.
Yeah, and a lot of people that just needed a job. Yes, I agree. It's quite a surprise. And rather than belabor it anymore, Arnie, why don't you give her the plot and we can get into everything that's surprising about The Manitou.
When Susan Strasberg's character Karen finds a large lump on the back of her neck, she goes to see specialist Dr. Jack Hughes, played by John Seder. Hughes recommends surgical removal, so to calm her nerves, Karen calls up her dime store psychic ex-boyfriend Harry Erskine, played by Tony Curtis. Things start to go wrong. Dr. Hughes cuts himself with the scalpel when trying to remove Karen's tumor, and x-rays show the tumor to be housing a rapidly growing fetus in the back of her neck. Erskine goes to see anthropologist Dr. Snow, played by Burgess Meredith, who wrote about such a happening where a dead Native American medicine man's Manitou, or spirit, could spontaneously form in another person. The Manitou would grow to full size, killing the host and becoming reborn. To try to save Karen, Erskine goes to a living shaman, John Singing Rock, played by Michael Ansara. Going to see Karen in her hospital room, John does what he can, but the Manitou spirit births a half-sized version of Miskamakis, the most powerful shaman there ever was. And Miskamakis begins to summon the Great Old One who will destroy the world. John's magic is too weak, but Erskine has a plan to turn on every computer in the hospital. See, everything has a Manitou. A scalpel, a telephone, a pocket pussy, a computer. They all have Manitou.
I think they're all in this climax.
John's love for Karen takes the Manitous from all the computers and focuses them into lightning bolts that banish Miskamakis and prevents the coming of the Great Old One. As credits roll.
I think this was promoting coming, not preventing it.
She's really enjoying giving him those jazz hand lasers. Totally Star Wars.
Power! Unlimited power!
Now, as we start, let's start with the illustrious people that are involved with this. Lalo Schifrin, the man that came up with the Mission Impossible theme. Oscar winner. He's doing the music here, all of the tom-toms and what have you here. If they took away this credit sequence, how long would it take for you to realize that a Native American medicine man was the evil spirit in this movie? I think the reason why we have this music and this opening with masks is so that it doesn't totally throw people when that pops up late in the film.
Yeah, because Panawitchi Salatu, I don't associate that with Native American languages typically.
Or anything, maybe baby speak.
Yeah, witchy woman, the eagles, that's where I went. But you know what? I didn't realize it was a medicine man until they said it out loud. And then I went, oh, now the totem poles make sense. But I was looking at these images and I'm like, okay, there's a totem pole. There's some other imagery, and I wasn't sure if they were trying to pull from Buddhism and Eastern philosophies and Native American philosophies, or if it was all Native American, but they jump right into this. I was kind of happy that we didn't spend the first half an hour with Karen being like, what's this pimple on the back of my neck? Let me try to pop it.
Oh, no. It's already the size of a grapefruit, and it's only been there for 3 days. We start very Exorcist. I do feel like if you want to talk about a slow opener, William Friedkin spends a long time with people looking at x-rays and taking that 12-year-old Regan and trying to see what's wrong with her. Opening shot, we see two guys that maybe they're doctors, or maybe they're Century 21 realtors in those mustard jackets. I'm not sure, but they're trying to figure out what to do with her ever-growing neck lump.
Yeah, it is awfully big at the beginning, and we're introduced to two different doctors here. It's hard for me to tell who's the important one in this scene. You've got your specialist, who's Dr. Hughes, but he storms out, and there's all this talk about you can be a doctor, be a lawyer, but don't be an administrator. I didn't think either of them were as in danger of that.
Ironically, the reason why this performance is so bad is it's actually a non-actor. The producer of this movie, John Cedar, and a longtime friend of this director going all the way back to Louisville, just wanted to be in the film. So I guess he's being the administrator.
He's providing the money, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're the administrator, so you get to be Dr. Hughes. And then we get Karen here, and am I wrong that this feels like a cautionary response to Deep Throat? Like, be careful what you stick down your neck, because you might have to deal with the consequences 9 months later.
It is crazy how quickly, like, they're talking about, I don't know, she's got this lump, there's no pain coming from it, but it's growing really fast. And then, hey, look at this poster of a developing fetus. It could be a baby in there, guys. Like, it is a weird leap that they'd make very quickly.
What I love most is, again, Lee Strasberg's daughter, trained in the method, is sitting there going, you know, is it okay that five times a day someone is shifting like they're trying to get comfortable in bed? They're like, oh, yeah, it's fine. I have a canker sore that does a jogging routine around my mouth. It's totally normal to have things in your body moving around like they're alive.
Here's the weird thing with Karen. Why did she get chosen by this evil spirit or the devil, as we talked about in Rosemary's Baby or The Omen and all that? Like, they'll say she was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that is it. I have no idea. She's very nonchalant about this huge boil on her neck.
Actually, they say she's in the right place in the wrong time, which really confused me.
Okay, yeah. See, I corrected my head because that doesn't make sense.
Like everything in this movie, it just, what? What are you talking about? Having read the novel, there is a reason. Largely structurally, the book and movie are the same. It's clear that the director was a fan of the book because he really tried to capture it. But I think he read it really fast and he threw out things that weren't very important, like logic and reasoning and setup. And the story is set in the novel in New York Harbor, and there is no Panawitchi Salatu.
No, really?
Well, they improved the novel then.
Yes. No, the chant she is having is a native language in which she's always saying, Das Boot, Das Boot, Das Boot.
That's German.
Yes. And it turns out that there are Dutch sailors arriving, and it's the Native American people experiencing the arrival of European colonists. And the reason this is all happening is because the medicine man watched his people wipe out and wanted to come back and get the descendants. So I'm not saying there was an enormous reason, but there was at least a setup in place and in time. And then some of this nonsense comes together as a revenge plot for a wiped out culture. But that's far less fun than just a woman saying nonsense in her sleep and running to her lover, which is another change. In the book, she gets this diagnosis that we're going to have to operate on your tumor and is immediately alarmed and goes to see a psychic to try and ease her mind, because who else can tell her about the future?
Well, she does go to see a psychic.
Well, yes, but that's because she knows and loves and lusts for Tony Curtis. Trying to compete with his wife and daughter here. Screen queen Janet Leigh is, you know, the lead of Psycho. Daughter Jamie Leigh would have Halloween this year. This is his first horror movie. You guys seen much of his work? Are you familiar with what he means coming into this movie late in his career?
Not really. I know he's in, what, Spartacus or Ben-Hur? I don't know. One of those big epics, isn't he? I know I've seen him before, but I'm not very familiar with his career.
He started his career in Swords and Sandals movies. He was never considered a particularly great actor, but he was buff and would just play swashbuckling roles. And then slowly but surely, he learned the craft of acting and kind of did become legitimate. And, you know, the way we see him here, it's a comedy role. He's all dressed up, pretending he has psychic powers. Kind of reminds me of Bill Murray in Ghostbusters or Whoopi Goldberg in Ghost. Someone that knows that they're a sham, but profits off the idea or gets laid because he can, in this case, con old ladies who just like to be talked to because no one else pays them any attention. But he has done drag before. He is the star of Some Like It Hot. So this would be the Tony Curtis of that era. Like, this is him trying to go back and do that kind of comedy.
So my question is, they broke up, right? And so she calls him, even though they're broken up, for a booty call with this dime store tarot guy?
She doesn't believe in his card readings.
She's cool with him scamming old ladies then.
Yeah, I feel like she is wanting, yes, to get her mind off of what's going on here.
Yeah, this opening scene with him is a little bit over the top right there as he's giving a tarot read to this really old woman, and he's quite obviously just not even taking it seriously, and she must be the easiest rube ever to walk the earth.
Right, he's making up mantras for her, and as soon as she's gone, he's turning on the disco, and
that is some very disco disco that he turns on as soon as she leaves.
Slits in a wine glass. Is it too much? I'd have to pick up the Tony Curtis autobiography to know. I have to know what he says about doing this movie. Curtis said he was really, really angry at Marlon Brando, which he considered his contemporary. Brando's off doing The Godfather, Last Tango in Paris, and he's getting shit like this. And so he said he was tried like hell in this movie. This is someone really, really trying to do good work, even though he recognizes it's not a good film.
Really?
Yes.
Like, this is his good work.
This is him saying, I'm still acting, damn it, hire me. Around the same time, he made a sequel to The Bad News Bears, where they went to Japan, really bad. He made Mae West's last film, Sextet, also really bad.
When he's in character as this psychic, he all of a sudden becomes very flamboyant and, like, it just has this whole air about him. I actually found it kind of entertaining. I don't know if because it was actually entertaining or it's just so bad, but he does take on a different persona when he's reading the cards with old ladies.
Yes, it's San Francisco. He's a swinging bachelor that is way past middle age. Does he read gay? Some Like It Hot. You could definitely see that there. But the popular notion of Tony Curtis in 1978 wouldn't necessarily read that way. I think we're supposed to take him as just a sexy guy who makes his living by putting on a stunt and, yeah, can then take that money and then go wine and dine women like Carrot.
Because, again, when he's a psychic, I'm kind of like what he's doing with the character, but it's not what I would say, oh, this is someone that's just trying to kill it with their acting. Like, I'm bringing Oscar-worthy acting to a B-horror film. That is not how I would read his performance.
You know what? There were a couple of times I did. Like, when he was arguing with the doctor a little later in the film, there were times where I'm like, wow, he's really playing this as if he's worried for her life. He is really selling me on his anger. It was more than I had expected. It was more than I would get out of The Omen in many cases. I never got out of Gregory Peck what I'm getting out of Tony Curtis.
To me, I feel like it's always like he's in a Mel Brooks movie or something. Like, I feel like he's using comedy chops. There's an eye rolling to his performance, both when he's the great Erskine and when he's supposedly worried about, yeah, this chick here. Shortly after this movie, his cocaine problem began, but he is not on cocaine during this film.
Yeah, this is the kind of film that drives you to cocaine.
It is, yes. So she calls out of the blue during amid his like disco dancing number. And, you know, it's like, I have a baby in my neck and it's yours. And they go on this really long all day San Francisco date.
It is too long, this scene, and the score just swelling. Ugh.
At no time are they showing any concern. He never even looks at her neck. Like, he's like, it'll be nothing.
No, she has this like big apple on the back of her neck, but it's just covered by her collar and her hair. I mean, I presume they did have sex. Did he never look at her from behind? Did he never see this shit? I mean, because I'll tell you, that's a quick way to kill the mood is, what the fuck is on your neck?
She has very good scarves that are always covering it up.
If someone came to you and says, I have a tumor and they're operating tomorrow and I'm worried, the fact that you're like, I'm sure it'll be fine and let's go have some crack crab and go back to my place. It's really just, it's a very funny, bizarre chemistry here. Like, I can't believe this is going to be the relationship that we're expected to buy here. But that's it. They're lovers.
Which doesn't have any effect on the story. If they were just friends, like, he would have done the same stuff to try to help her out and do all this. Send electricity through her tits to kill the bad guy. Like, he would have done all this if they were just really good friends. The fact that they're lovers. Again, Karen is such a blank slate. I know nothing about her. And I feel like I never get to know the character. So, yeah, I'm going along with Harry because at least Curtis is doing a fun performance there.
This is a huge shock to me, is how little of the movie Karen is, when Karen is presumably the main character. She is the protagonist. She is the one who has something to overcome.
It's funny when you say it that way.
She's not the main character, but she's the protagonist.
Yeah.
And so I wish I got from this scene what their relationship used to be, why they had the falling out, all of this. I want to know more about their relationship.
Oh, you do. She doesn't approve. Like, she's saying you should do more with your life. You're conning old ladies, and I don't believe in your tarot reading. And he's like, oh, let me reassure you by reading that tarot card. Of course, he's going to pull up the devil and the moon and the death card and be like, oh, you're going to live to be 104. Let's fuck. Like, he's not really trying to set her at ease. This, to him, is a booty call. For her, likewise, she just needed to relax. It's the 70s, and he's the only single straight man in San Francisco she can call up in last minute. So, yes, as she goes off to sleep after their night together by the fireplace, yes, this is a made-up chant that, I mean, ask any six-year-old, and they would come up with something better than Panna Witchy Solitude, but I love it. She says it in the evening. She says it during surgery. And it seems to have some kind of psychopathic effect because it's making her surgeon slice his wrists open. And it's even making some of the old ladies go crazy, too.
Yeah, when he sliced his own wrist, I was a little bit confused as to exactly what was going on there. But I figured it was the tumor doing telekinesis.
Oh, you see Karen open her eyes and do that stare. And yeah, I knew what was going on. The tumor's in control.
You know there's something bad in her. I mean, again, it's pretty clear that there's exorcist.
Neck fetuses are never good. Abortion for all neck fetuses. That's my stance.
But yes, the greatest action stunt of all time, I'm going to just call it right now, my favorite stunt. You can have Tom Cruise hang off a real airplane. You can have Bruce Willis jump off the Nakatomi in explosions. And you ask me what the best stunt ever filmed is, it's going to be Mrs. Hertz going down those goddamn stairs.
Did I rewind and watch this scene like 10 times?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Me too. It's so good.
It caught me so off guard because it's a cool scene. You know, Harry's doing one of his readings with this old lady. And of course, the death card comes up and she starts having like these seizures. And then she's floating. I'm like, oh, this is a great visual. And then all of a sudden, like someone just got thrown down the stairs. Like it is such a quick cut to this body just taking out the banister. I'm like, oh, I got to see that again.
The stuntman is like clearly directed. Don't just fall down the stairs. Take it all out. Destroy the whole set. And there's like blood on the wall. And it's not even from like this moment. It's something that happened earlier and unrelated. Like this is just a weird apartment building.
Yeah, I thought more was going to happen because they film this lady from a 90 degree angle for quite a bit of it and have her in the right of the frame as she's floating, but she's not floating across frame. The camera's moving as she's moving. I expected her to open her mouth and have something come out and they were doing some forced perspective or something. I thought more was going to come of it because of some of the strange camera angles being used, but no, she just floats away.
Is it not good enough that a man threw himself down the stairs for your entertainment?
Well, Chevy Chase did that in the 70s too, so sure.
She comes in like with a cane, can barely move, and then she's up there. I mean, this is where you want your disco song. Like, she's dancing and Panna Witchy, like all of it. Like, in the strange slow-mo as Tony Curtis is running to her and like, you're right, 10 times. I just kept going back and watching it again and again. I can never get enough of this moment.
It is my favorite scene of the whole film.
Oh, easily.
And I don't know what it has to do with the rest of the film, quite frankly. You probably should cut it for 100 different reasons, but goddamn you to hell if you do. Like, you deserve to burn.
You deserve a neck fetus if you cut this scene.
The point is that we know that this phrase is bad and it causes harm. People are hurting themselves. Erskine should be worried at this point. He's been very nonchalant about it all. And now he's going to go on his act to search for spiritual answers. Starting with confronting the Dr. Hughes, he goes to him, and the office, like, talk about, like, setting up in Act 1 what you're going to do in Act 3.
You read the book. Were these set in the future? Because that computer man in his office is great. Like, that is off the set of Star Trek.
It did. That is exactly what I said, is what is this big Star Trek-looking console doing in this doctor's office? It was an eyesore that drew attention to itself.
Yeah.
Every time you see that thing, I'm distracted by it.
Yeah, really. I've like, he never touched it. He never used it. He never called up x-rays on it.
He's a surgeon. Why would he? Like, why would he have this?
Not an administrator.
Or maybe he's the administrator. You're right. Who knows what he's doing on this mainframe? Like, again, most of his bookcase is this giant computer, but he's not looking at it. Like, they're doing everything. Like, he's looking out at this cardboard San Francisco at his window and pretending that, like, I've seen a million tumors in my life, but never one that's made of flesh and blood, almost a fetus. And then again, Tony Curtis in his comic timing, he's like, on her neck. It feels young Frankenstein. It's a surprise to know that this was played straight as a novel. And it's a surprise that I think this director half the time is trying to do comedy and half the time seems committed to capturing the spirit of the book.
Some of this comedy has to be intentional. It's so campy at times. They had to have that in mind when they were doing it.
My guess is that the people that were making it funny were the actors. Because what do? You're being handed this. You're Tony Curtis. You've worked with Billy Wilder and great comedians. And so you're going to just use that because you can't do anything else with this material. So I don't think the director is as much in control with the idea that this is funny as the actors.
The film is tonally all over the place, but it is in this portion where that really starts to become a problem for me, because I'm not able to follow this Erskine on his emotional journey of going for this woman who he hadn't seen in an undeterminate period of time to now his only focus in life is figuring out what's going on with her.
Or maybe he's just looking for other women, because, like, this is an excuse to ring up his mentor, Amelia Crusoe, Stella Stevens, who taught him everything that he knows about being a medium, which is not much, but has gotten out of the racket and is now running a tourist trap in the, I guess, Fisherman's Wharf area. She's legit, and he needs her skills because he knows he doesn't have the spiritualism to actually find out what's going on in Karen's neck.
Yeah, and he can't just get a reading. No palms here. We got to do a full seance.
Yeah, she's married to this real, I don't know, he looks like the third wheel in a folk trio or something like this. This MacArthur, who can't be bothered by any of it. But yeah, they all go traipsing over to Karen's aunt so they can ruin her dining room table.
Is that who that was? I'm like, who's this old lady that's with them all of a sudden?
Yes, yeah. She's the rich aunt that's going to fuel their whole entire mission from this point on. She's so worried about her niece's neck tumor that she's going to let them host a seance.
This was not an established location or an established aunt. They cared more about setting up that computer than they care about the people in Karen's family.
Right. Yes. But again, that's part of the fun, is the discombobulated, where are we going to now craziness. It's worth pointing out, the same summer as Star Wars, we mentioned it on the Suspiria podcast, that Argento movie was a big drive-in hit. You can see the influence in this scene, the lighting schemes that they're even shooting in Panavision. This movie, again, $3 million is a lot more than most B-movies had at this time. And you can see on a certain level, there's a technical professionalism that you won't find in any Tommy Wiseau or Ed Wood production.
No, you're right. I mean, it is funny. Whenever they got to just do a cutaway scenic shot, they're always showing the Golden Gate Bridge, just like Tommy Wiseau did in The Room, like, where nothing takes place on the Golden Gate Bridge, like, just show outside the house. But when they do this seance and this head is rising from this blackness and it's just all black, like, it looks super cool. Like, I love the look of it. Where they go with this, the conclusions they come to based on such little evidence is crazy in this film. But I love the look of this, and, like, I'm leaning in. saying because I'm trying to like understand what it's saying and it's all garbled. Like, it's great.
Actually, I had a real problem with the audio mix on this movie. I had to turn on subtitles because there were many scenes, including this one, where I felt like the music or the sound effects were drowning out dialogue. And in many cases, this was important dialogue that was being drowned out by score. Here, maybe you weren't supposed to catch every word because it was a noisy seance going nuts. But I feel like this film does have technical flaws.
Well, obviously.
No one's going to disagree with you, Arnie. It's got a lot of flaws, for sure. Technical and otherwise.
Well, you were touting how much money it had. Well, that didn't help with the audio, is what I'm saying.
For an Ed Wood movie, it is a blockbuster. It's Terminator 2.
Yeah, because what's crazy is they see, like, this head, it garbles something out. They don't understand it. They're like, I guess it's the ant. She's like, oh, that looks like a wooden Indian I've seen. It must be an Indian. This all has to do with Indians.
Now, all of a sudden, this is the moment that if you had come in late and didn't see that opening credits, you suddenly realize, wait, Native Americans?
Yeah, here's the thing. I watched that trailer. They show a Native American. Like, they make a big deal. It's a white dude and Native American teaming up to fight something. I had forgotten all that because I just remembered Neck Fetus. And so I got here. I'm like, oh, yeah, we're getting the whole Native American thing. Let's see how they deal with this in 1978.
Yeah, this is when the opening credits finally made sense to me. But I'm like, oh, boy, this is not going to be culturally sensitive, is it?
Yeah, the director wasn't in any way concerned about making a statement pro or con colonialism and Manifest Destiny. Like, he wasn't interested in that.
Oh, I noticed there's a distinct lack of subtext to this film.
Yes, he removes as much as he can from Masterson's work. But in the novel, it is the thrust of what's going on. The whole reason why the medicine man is coming back is to get white man. And in fact, Miskimakis is always, in all of his future sequels, trying to figure out a way of reverting the world so that it goes back to a pre-machine, pre-computer, pre-Western colonization America.
So Miskimakis is the villain in all the books?
For the most part. We'll talk about the later novels that Masterton wrote, but there are 7 additional stories, and I read them all. But yeah, at this point, all we know is the definition of Manitou, and that's because of Mac. Mac, of all people, cared enough to pick up a book while they're all freaking out about the broken table and what's going on at the Haunted Mansion.
Why didn't the Manitou have such a vengeance against that table?
The lightning particularly just wanted to strike that, break it in half. I don't know. It's fun. I appreciate that. But yeah, he picks up a book and says, hey, a Manitou is an immortal spirit that can be reborn at any time or place in the future or past by impregnating the body of a man, woman, or animal. I'm just like, okay, that couldn't be less vague.
Stuart, they figured out from that little head that popped up from the table that this all had to do with Native Americans. Like, they're very good at jumping to conclusions.
Yeah, and it means most importantly, and I don't know why Neck Fetus didn't trigger this from them, but Karen is pregnant. She's going to give birth, which makes me really excited for that gender reveal party. Like, will the vomit be pink? Will it be blue? It's really exciting. And so they're going to find this author of this book in the Sausalito Yellow Pages, drive over the Golden Gate Bridge, and ask Burgess Meredith, where did he get those funky glasses?
Yeah, Dr. Ernest Snow, who wrote a book he apparently doesn't give a shit about, like, doesn't believe a word he wrote.
Yeah, I love Burgess Meredith in this, because he's like, did I agree to do this movie? I'm not reading these pages. I'll just, whatever.
Yeah, what Tony Curtis gave, Burgess Meredith took away.
He's doing everything he can to get out of the scene. And who can blame him?
Like, he literally, like, leaves. He's like, oh, you guys, you make yourself at home. I'm leaving.
He leaves him in his cobweb-covered attic. Like, I can't do this anymore, but let me tell you some bullshit about what's going on.
What I love about Meredith, that he is such a linguist. You just say, Punawitchy, and he's like, yes, yes, yes. Like, he's able to figure out this nonsense word.
Yeah, the Piscataqua tribe, who died out 400 years ago. But the important detail there to catch is they died out before white man even arrived. So again, they've removed the idea that this is a revenge story. This tribe died off for whatever reason, and now this Native American is coming back. And in fact, Panawitchi Salatu, Meredith thinks, it could mean my death foretells my return. The medicine man from 400 years ago is coming back And why not? Because it's fun to pop out of people's backside.
And one appeared in an arm. This one appears in a neck. We're never given any reason. We're never told any reason why she is picked. You know, I was happy that they jumped straight into there's a neck fetus, but I did miss the exorcist, oh, you played with a Ouija board and kind of caused this. You summoned it.
That's what I'm saying. What did Karen do? You always have to do something or be in some scenario like where this gets cursed upon you, but...
Smoke an American Spirit cigarette, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe. But these Manitous, like, if you're such a super smart shaman that's just going to be reincarnated over and over, like, you're calling yourself out if you're going to grow up on someone's neck or their arm. Like, just grow in the womb like a normal thing and no one will suspect anything.
The book does go into greater detail about how by being in the neck, it doesn't get the nutrients that it would be from her womb. And there's a little bit more detail, but no explanation. You are correct. It's done that way to shock us. It is shocking to think about a fetus in somebody's neck. And so the last parting words of advice from Burgess Meredith is, why not fight fire with fire? Go find yourself a South Dakota medicine man. And I love that Harry's first thought on that is, but how are we going to pay for that? I mean, okay, I guess good thing Karen has a rich aunt, so she can pay for all your gasoline to drive out to South Dakota.
Yeah, you know Karen's got some money, because when we see her next, they're going to laser that boil off of her neck. And we get a whole, like, you talk about Star Wars, man, here's a whole laser scene. Lasers going everywhere.
And she's looking like the Hunchback at this point. I mean, like, it's not a lump. It is like... a whole twin sister kind of thing, like hanging out of her spinal cord.
And they also, again, just for reasons, they're just super smart doctors or whatever. Now they're like, oh, whatever's in her neck is in pain because like x-rays are hurting it or whatnot. Like, again, I don't know how they come to these conclusions in this film, but.
The line that she says, speaking as her lump, he says you will not touch him. You hurt him with the light. He is in pain and he will kill you all. So the reason why this Native American was coming back was just probably to see 1978 and maybe go to the Castro district or something, have fun with the village people. But now that you zapped him with radiation, like, oh shit, he's mad. He's going to get all of you doctors. Malpractice has got him furious.
And I thought this was going to be the subtext of the film, or maybe just the text of like technology versus, you know, the old Native American ways and Mother Earth and getting back to nature, because it was the x-rays. It's this radiation that these machines that didn't exist 400 years ago when he did that have hurt him. And so that's what he's going to focus on getting his revenge on.
Now, first of all, I don't think that if you give an x-ray to a pregnant woman, that baby's lost a leg because you've killed a cell. I don't think that's exactly how that works.
But we do have sonograms. We don't normally put them under x-ray machines. They take precautions.
They take precautions. I'm just saying, I don't think that exposure to a single x-ray means your baby has no leg. And second, if that demon was hurt by x-rays, x-ray the hell out of it. Why do you not do that again? Why do you need this laser? Obviously, it couldn't stop the x-ray.
That's the ending of the film.
Yeah, well, I think that's why he's destroying all the equipment here, starting with the laser. They were going to try to take the fetus out, and we now understand that it cannot be removed without killing her. Nor does she want them to do it. She is symbiotic with this evil force in her. And so, yeah, they're going to have to take Burgess Meredith's advice, drive out to South Dakota, although I think it's Calabasas. I've lived in South Dakota. It ain't green. This is not South Dakota. But, yeah, I mean, Singing Rock is... ready to do anything.
This is the sixth one they've gone to, by the way. He found five other medicine men before this one.
Yeah, he's been out there hoeing herbs or something. And what, you say a white woman's got a fetus in his neck? Sure, I'm there.
But Harry does have to come up with $100,000 to give to an Indian education fund, plus some tobacco. There's your casual racism for the Native American there. But was he serious about the $100,000? I don't think Harry has $100,000 to give to an education fund.
I think he was more concerned about that bag of tobacco, too, if you ask me. But we're getting more of the mythology here, and we're getting closer to Lovecraft. It's mentioned that there is a Gitche Manitou, which does, again, you're right, Gitche Gitche Manitou.
The way I read this whole Gitche Manitou thing is like these reincarnating medicine men, when they like reach a certain level, they get absorbed back into Gitche?
Eight times, and you get to be with him forever.
Oh, it's got to be eight times. Okay.
Yeah. And this one, whatever he is, and they don't have a name yet, but he is on his fourth incarnation or so. I mean, again, this guy hasn't even seen the lump, and he's got all of this diagnosis about what's going to happen here. But yes, we're to understand that this is a medicine man trying to achieve eternity, trying to go to the afterlife. And so, you know, Burgess Meredith also made the suggestion. Maybe you don't want to hurt him. Maybe he's not really the enemy. Although we've had that scene in the surgery room with the laser to know that he's ready to get him some doctors. He's definitely on the warpath to get some scalps from Dr. Hughes and anyone that put him under the radiation. And Dr. Hughes doesn't want this Native American to come back into the hospital either. They make him like, they sneak him in yellow scrubs so that like nobody knows that they're actually going to like surround the bed with sand and shake some corn stalks or something.
I love as soon as he gets into the hospital room, he's like, I can't work with these robes. I got to take them off. And he doesn't circle that whole bed in sand. No. I think that is the problem. They need to pull the bed out so they can get behind the...
It's not a circle. It is not a circle. I agree. It's so lazy. So this is where the name dropped. Karen opens up and she's croaking, kind of doing like her Reagan thing from Exorcist, and says she is Miss Bamakis, which perks up Singing Rock's ears and perks up mine, because this is actually a character from somebody else's mythology. An unfinished Lovecraft novel had this Miss Bamakis character, and other people have taken him and used him in books. So there is a whole lore outside of the Manitou about a powerful Native American shaman who has the ability to reincarnate. And it is tying this story in with Lovecraft. Later, we're going to get some old ones, and he's going to conjure some ancient ones. Like, this is exciting for people that have always wanted to see Lovecraft on screen. It doesn't happen very often, and you're not even supposed to see an ancient one. Like, the whole thing is, if you ever see one of the monsters, you'll go crazy. And I guarantee you, when you see these monsters, you are going to go crazy. It's really amazing once she finally starts giving birth from her neck back.
Which happened much earlier than I expected. I thought that would be like the climax of the film, but no, they're going to bring out a naked little person wooden Indian for the last act of the film.
Two actors, one to actually do the performance and then one to do the stunts. One was a circus performer, and I guess that was the one they strung up on wires and did some other stuff here.
Which one was naked? Because that
Karen was. She was the naked one.
No, one of those Manitous had back. I mean, it was weird. I thought it was a statue.
Yeah, I think he needs to read one of those Graham Masterson sex manuals and learn to have more confidence in being small. Like, it's he's slimy but jacked. He's kind of, if they were to remake this, I would cast him with Danzig. I feel like that would be like the perfect person for this.
It is very weird looking. Like, I had to rewind this because it is kind of dark in the scene. And I'm like, is that a person, like a full-size person that doesn't have legs? Is that supposed to be a little person? Like, what is going on? Because they said, like, that x-ray, it took a cell that was going to become a leg or something, and he's supposed to come out full-size, but he's obviously not. But it's just weird proportions by the makeup they use and all that. I had to rewind it and brighten my set a little bit to see what was really going on.
It's a birth defect. And again, so if he had popped out, you know, fully formed, it would be a very different movie. I can tell you none of what follows afterwards would have happened. He would have just been happy to be alive and walking among us here in San Francisco.
But is this how he was supposed to come out, or was it the fact that John was there that made him come out little?
No, it's the radiation. The radiation made him small.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's deformed. It's essentially, you deformed me by taking all those x-rays, and so now I'm going to get you. Now, I do think Masterson made it a little person in part because he was aware of a historical Manitou. Like, in the early 20th century, traveling around in sideshows was a little person who called himself the Manitou and performed lots of tricks, got shot out of a cannon and all of that kind of stuff. So I think it was always in Masterson's idea that, like, I'm going to make it a small guy. But the reason given within the universe, within the story, is he's Godzilla. Radiation made him the monster that he is.
I still can't believe that those were actors. I really thought it was just a really bad puppet.
Yeah, it is kind of like the greatest Chuck E. Cheese animatronic ever. Like, he's just kind of casting his spells and doing these robot moves. And his first trick is he's going to, like, kill the orderly. Like, there's two orderlies. There's Michael and then there's Wolf. And we have Tony Curtis going down the hall to hit on the head nurse, get some Alka-Seltzer that won't fizz in water because, hey.
He's there for the woman he loves, but hey, nurse, hey.
He's just trying to hook up. I don't think he's truly in love with this Karen. Like, he's just trying to get some. And when he goes back to the room, it's a jump scare. In the novel, it was a little more clear. Miss Gamakis had turned Michael inside out. And so the reason why he's bloody and all of that is he's an inside out zombie now attacking the other orderly, Wolf.
Okay, I thought they were saying his skin had been ripped off. I didn't get inside out. I just thought Hellraiser ripped the flesh off.
Oh, I thought it was ripped off because they literally throw a dude's face out a window.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, again, this is, I don't know what they were doing for the movie. I was just, in the novel, it was a trick to show the inner white man, I think, is the point. But they do what the special effects will allow them to do, and makeup effects were not what they are even a few years later with the slasher movies that came out in the 80s. Like, these are fairly crude latex things that are going on here, but still kind of fun. Like, I'm laughing a lot.
Oh, no, I'm cracking up when this thing hits the window and they're like, a face. I'm like, yeah, and it looks exactly like what you would expect a face to look like when it hits the window. Like,
I thought it was bloody just because it broke glass and like that would hurt you, but I guess the skin ripped off.
Yeah, and I love, like, the other guy was just told to, like, throw a sheet over him. Like, no one wants to move the body. No one's really going to, like, attend to this patient. Wouldn't you really have her dismissed at this point? If you can't, like, remove the lump and she's going to kill you with the, like, surgical laser.
Is insurance even going to cover this? I mean, no! Usually these long hospital stays, you need pre-approval.
You guys are sounding like administrators.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to reject this claim and say she got to go right now. You don't, like, clear out the 10th floor and let her just wig out like she could just take over the whole place with her demons. So, like, the doctor wants to actually call the police. The wisely, Dr. Hughes is like, let's get the cops in here. This was a scene in the book where they came in, they had guns.
Did you get to see the guns Manitous?
Yeah, the guns Manitous turned against them and they all shot themselves and all of that stuff. Here's just mentioned that that's what could happen if they bring in other actors, going to raise the budget. And so Miss Gamakis is going to summon an ancient one. I want it to be Lovecraft, but it ends up looking like Land of the Lost. It's like this little dinosaur lizard of the tree.
Well, yeah, that's just the lizard of the trees. That's not the ancient evil one we're going to get at the end.
Yeah, there's three demons that he summons. The first one, in the book, he eats the doctor's fingers. I don't know if that comes through or if that even happens.
No, I thought he just kind of like bit Dr. Hughes and that was it. I'm like, he doesn't die? Like, he's just going to bite him?
I feel like he should die. I feel like that character is awful enough. But again, he's the producer.
But he's got to overload that giant computer in his office at the end.
I guess that's his point. But he got two doctors. I figure you got to kill one of them here. You want to see a few more deaths. Something funny that I never remember when watching this movie, I think I'm seeing a lot of nudity and blood. But this is a PG movie. It's actually fairly tame, although it doesn't feel like it because it's just so crazy.
It kind of felt like it to me. When this guy dies with his skin ripped off, I'm like, nobody has died. It's just one person now.
That old lady who threw herself down the stairs.
Well, I forgot about the old lady, but she was as good as dead anyway. I thought she just had a death rattle and was dying when she started her convulsions.
Yeah, but I mean, like, again, I think I'm seeing boob, and I guess I'm not, but, like, it feels kind of porno, and then, like, people are slicing themselves. And
I don't get a porno feel out of this.
Oh, towards the end, we're not there yet, but...
All right, yeah, I'm like, when we get to the end, though, her revival is definitely page 69 of one of Masterson's how-tos.
Yeah, as I wrote down in my notes, weird time for a titty shot. Like, that was not the time I was expecting it in this film.
So the second demon is the Star Beast, which means that he's going to freeze the entire floor. And we get Curtis wearing, like, the tightest shirt ever. It just needs sparkles and ice skates. And, like, he's ready for the Olympics here.
It does feel like a Disney ride or something, these giant icicles. Joel Schumacher was inspired for Batman and Robin with this set.
Another strange camera angle, too, is when we get to see John fighting this. It's just, like, POV Manitou as John shakes maracas at it?
Yeah, the corn husk trick. And, you know, singing rock off screen, he gets surgical equipment thrown in his face. He's all cut up. that poor nurse that Harry was hitting on, like, no one evacuated her. She stayed at her post, and she's repaid by being frozen solid. And then when the two men are, like, trying to fight the spirit, they fly into her and her head breaks off. That was fun.
The way they stop the ice storm is Erskine throws a typewriter.
You gotta love this. This is sort of a tip off to how they're going to defeat the evil. He just grabs whatever is nearby, and it just happens to be a typewriter, which electronic typewriters would have been relatively new to. That would have been cutting edge within the last 10 years.
I don't even know why you need a typewriter when you got that computer.
We got to build up to the computer. Right now, it's just a typewriter. And because it has a Manitou that is so modern and cutting edge that Star Beast has never seen it before, it just blows up. And so now they have an in.
So let's follow this. We're told everything has a Manitou.
Yeah.
So my desk here has a Manitou?
Sure.
Absolutely.
But does the desk top, which is wood, have a Manitou? And then each leg, which is metal, have separate Manitous? When I assembled this from IKEA, did I merge Manitous?
I don't think so. I would tend to think that if you define it as one thing, that is the Manitou of it. Like, I wouldn't have a fingernail Manitou and a molar Manitou. I would just have a Manitou of me.
I mean, is this an actual Native American belief? Because I don't want to make fun of it if it is, but this is some bullshit.
I mean, there are Eastern philosophies that subscribe to espousing nature as a god. Yes, there's a lot to this.
No, but saying my pencil has a soul is a little bit different than saying nature is a god.
I mean, I'm sure there might be some Native American tribe. I know there's other religions and philosophies that go by this, so it's not totally made up.
Yeah, I don't think it's totally made up because Masterton does do his research, and some of this stuff that's in the novel, which winds up into this movie, is founded on some kind of exploration on actual belief systems of Native people. So, again, I didn't really go in here with a fine-tooth comb about the factual accuracies of what I'm experiencing. But it is, as you say, it's a silly concept to think that, yeah, not only does my pencil has a soul, but my, you know, PC computer can beat it up. Like that, depending on how new the Manitou is, it can take on the old Manitous.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the belief that everything has a Manitou. It's the way they go about, like, now it's Pokemon. And yes. Like, do you have the right element to beat that element? Mm-hmm. Like, my electric Pokemon beats your, I don't know, Native American Manitou Pokemon.
It really does start to feel, and it helps that we just, you know, we watched that series not too long ago, but like, it really does take on that kind of quality here. And we're getting to the climax. So, like, if the newest thing is what's going to get Miskamakis, then, yeah, why don't we go back to Dr. Hugh's office and take a look at that computer and ride this awesome hydraulic ride that looks like a really fun, like, Disney attraction where the floor and everything is shaking. Because Satan is here. The great old one has been conjured. The last demon has been raised.
And the hospital room has turned into outer space with green stars. And you know what this is reminding me of? The climax of Doctor Strange, the TV movie.
Yep, I was thinking of Doctor Strange too, and I'm digging it.
Mm-hmm. Which was also kind of Star Wars and Exorcist, now that I think about it.
I was surprised we didn't see the weird phallic sheet monster from it.
We see fireballs, we see a lot here.
Yeah, so I thought the little Indian guy went, Harukin, and shot a fireball. I wanted more of that.
They did what they could. This movie had $3 million budget, and apparently, from what I can gather, a lot of it was the post-work of these effects. I mean, keep in mind, there weren't a lot of people that knew how to do Star Wars, and so they got in over their skis here, maybe quite literally, when they got to this Frozen set and had to turn it into 2001 A Space Odyssey.
This ending is some Deus Ex Machina bullshit.
Literally, it's machines. I mean, I love the fact that, like, Harry can't even, he doesn't even know what they are. He describes them as, like, how much of this kind of complicated stuff that needs electricity and voltage do you have? That's how he describes a computer.
Does this include an EKG machine? Does the X-ray machine itself count?
And if you turn that on to the computer, who would win? I mean, suddenly I want a battle bot, so where we just try to get the toothbrush to fight the Twinkie machine. I don't know. It could be so much fun.
here's the weird thing. Well, there's been a lot of weird things thus far in this film, but Karen, she's the main character, but she's not the protagonist. Like, we've all agreed about that. So I'm like, okay, Medicine Man versus Medicine Man. That is the showdown. Luke versus Vader. And no, it's all going to go through Karen, the character that we have not cared about at all. She's going to be the one that all of a sudden has the power and directs the electric Manitous. She's the one sitting up topless for some reason, shooting electricity.
My take on this is, and God only knows, I'm not saying I'm right. I don't know who could say what's going on in this scene. But we see Singing Rock kind of like slump over and give up and say, this is white man magic. I don't know how to manipulate computer magic. Manitous. So, Tony Curtis, this is your time to shine because you clearly know so much about computers. And so, he is going to use the electricity and computer Manitous to go through because he knows her body so well. I think he's puppeting her.
That's what they're trying to tell us?
I thought he was finally learning how to be a spiritualist and medium and using his former lover.
That would have made sense too. Anything other than Karen saving the day.
See, I didn't read it that way. What I read was that Erskine thought the electricity would flow through him because he's a psychic and everything, and it didn't. And so he thought they had lost, and then it starts going through Karen, and Erskine is confused, and John's like, it's your love for her. So he was projecting his love onto Karen and thus passing the power onto Karen. But Karen was doing this all on her own. John was standing there holding his dick, basically. He did nothing.
Yeah, it was love versus Lovecraft. I do feel like love is the thing that blows up the big Eye of Sauron thing in space. And they go into Stargate and all that. I mean, I do think we're supposed to see this as lovers coming together. Again, I call porno because it just feels like what she's going through feels like his electrical manipulation is some kind of sex act that you can show in a PG movie. Like, it feels like they're having sex in space.
See, I didn't get that at all. I felt like her moans were orgasmic when she was birthing the Manitow, but...
Oh, I definitely got it at this point.
I feel like she could really be enjoying what's going through her body when they turn it up to 11 here. And again, maybe part of what's in my head is the fact that I know Graham Masterton wrote all those sex manuals. And so, like, this just, it's in my thought process that, of course, he would have the ending be a big space orgasm.
All I got was bad animated lightning. I got no space orgasm.
And Miskimakis, or I think, charmingly, Tony Curtis ends up calling him Mixmaster. He just ends up being the splotch on the hospital floor that probably the orderly that lived will have to mop up while everyone else is, like, going back to their lives, riding the cable car, and Singing Rock's going back to South Dakota in a taxi.
Finally getting his tobacco.
Yeah, they're not going to waste any time on a denouement here. It's just, okay, he's dead. Here's some tobacco. Credits roll.
Wow, but maybe we'll meet Miskimakis again because he's not dead. That's the important part. They sent him back. Maybe he's now reincarnation 3 instead of 4. But yeah, he could definitely come back.
This confused me because they're like, fact, in 1969, Japan, like, a kid was born with a Manitou lump.
Okay, it is true. And we discussed this when we did the Dark Half.
Oh, yeah.
We discussed the parasitic twin and the other possible ways. But the difference is, and what this text at the end does not make clear, is it wasn't a lie.
No. I think this movie is totally accurate, medically responsible, and kids don't have oral sex, or you're going to have neck fetuses.
What confused me was, I'm like, did we just watch a period piece? Was this supposed to, because usually you jump forward. I guess going backwards in time saying, oh yeah, this also happened before, like, is a little weird.
But there are parasitic twins. There are not little wooden Native Americans coming out of people's necks.
Oh, so were they trying to say that, yeah, there is this kind of birth defect type of thing with that the kid in Japan? Oh, I just took it as them saying, ooh, you know, it's a horror movie. You always got to have that end stinger that the evil still exists. Okay, I did not take their fact as fact.
Yeah, no, it's not setting up the sequel in Japan 10 years before. It is saying, this happens, and you should not mock Karen for her experience. And yet, how can you not?
So, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend The Manitou? Jacob.
So, yeah, I really enjoyed this one a lot. And look, Is this a great film? No. Is it a good film? Maybe on the border. Is it it's so bad it's good? No, I think that it's better than that typical Brown era. Like, there's some ridiculous stuff, but there is some competence. Like, there were some visuals that I was really impressed with here. And yeah, it just ends up being an entertaining, campy B-horror film that I have a lot of fun during. Like, I don't think it's going to blow your socks off. But, you know, you said, Stuart, you showed this at a bad movie night. I'd have a hard time calling this a bad movie. Again, I really like these visuals, that crazy old lady going down the stairs. It's not going to scare your socks off, but you might laugh your socks off. Give this one a try, The Manitou. Recommend, and that recommend has a Manitou, so that's a double recommend.
Stuart.
You know, before I get to a recommend, let me just first offer my mystic mantra. Guard well the pips, and the fruit shall grow without let. But know that the harvest is more bountiful with a thick layer of fertilizer. Which is just another way of saying that the right shitty movie can foster appreciation for the really good ones. We like The Omen and Rosemary's Baby and Exorcist more when we see people plagiarize and try to one-up them in these bug nuts ripoffs. And not everyone can do this. I mean, coming off of the Uwe Boll movies in the Video Arcade retrospective, there's a lot of people with no talent out there that get movies made, and they're no fun at all to sit through. The ones that are fun to sit through are the people that have something, a particular kind of talent, whether it's convincing A-list talent like Tony Curtis and post-Rocky Burgess Meredith that this would be good for their career, or proficiency with the camera, or just that certain glee to shock people with outrageous humor and visuals. There's something that Gerder had that really makes this a joy to watch, like watching a child learn a craft here. Like, he didn't care anything about story. This movie makes no sense. And yet there is a talent, much in the same way I experienced The Room or an Ed Wood movie. There's some kind of joy in watching this independent filmmaker defy the rules and yet still emulate movies that we love so much. So, yeah, I have a really good time with it, and I hope you did too, Arnie.
You know, a lot of times on the show, we end by saying, yeah, we saw the same movie. Here, I think all three of us saw a totally different movie. Jacob saw one that he legitimately liked well enough to recommend. Stuart sees a Brown Arrow so bad it's good movie. And I see
a Red Arrow, right?
I see some 70s trash that has some fun moments, but deserves to be forgotten in the shadows of those greater films Stuart mentioned. If I had to side with one of you, I'm leaning more towards Stuart, because this is not a good movie. There are moments that I laughed out loud that make me just hover, is this the Brown Arrow or is this the Red Arrow? But then in those cases with the Brown Arrow, what I always end up asking myself is there enough to sustain the running time? The Room, there is enough laughter to sustain the entire running time and then watch it two more times. But a lot of them just have funny moments or funny scenes. And Tony Curtis's performance here is what comes closest to carrying the movie into camp the whole time. But I just couldn't get into it in a I'm laughing the whole way. By the end lightning battle, I was ready for the movie to go with the old ones into the hereafter. It's a weak not recommend.
But, and I want to highlight this part, because I agree, many, many movies that I call so bad they're good are difficult to sustain for 90 minutes. There are lulls in this movie where it's not particularly funny, and 5 or 10 minutes where you would shorn things to make it flow better. There probably is a better cut of this film, but you got to admit, there is some gems here. There are things that are very Green Arrow. And you would want to watch a clip reel at the very least. You wouldn't want to miss some of the things in this movie.
No, I definitely think go to YouTube and see if you can find the old lady screaming witchy and floating.
Watch it 10 times. Seriously, so great.
And then watch the Manitou get hit in the head with a typewriter.
I'm telling you, there's enough here. Like, if they can do 5 things that are outrageous, and I think this movie does, it's worth it. But would you be interested in a sequel? Because they were going to make it. Gerder was talking to Masterton, and Masterton had already written the next Harry Erskine adventure. He was not going to fight a medicine man. He was moving on to a genie in a bottle. It was called The Djinn. It was his next horror novel. And they were talking about how to make a swirling tornado come out of a bottle. But Goerter first wanted to make a drug trafficking movie because he literally made a movie every 4 months. And he was like, I got to go do this. And then we'll do your thing. And while on location shooting, here's the weird part. He was in a helicopter and it didn't crash. It exploded. I think midair, like it blew up. And so he died at the age of 30. No one else dared to try to make The Djinn or any of the later novels.
Time to reboot.
Yeah, I definitely feel like Masterton, if he is a master of the horror genre, he hasn't been brought to film by anybody else. I guess there was a Hunger TV series that they made a couple of his short stories into episodes. But by and large, this is a talent that has not seen many screen adaptations. And God damn it, if we can see 100 terrible Stephen King movies.
Yeah, we got another Children of the Corn coming this year. Let's get a Manitou 2.
Yeah, there are 7 literary sequels. I did read them all. None of them have the surprise. The truth of the matter is the shock value is all in the first one. Neck Fetus and the surprise of the story really can't be duplicated. But I can quickly run down what happens in the other face-offs. Revenge of the Manitou is the next one. And you can tell that Masterton was really thinking about The Omen because the targets are children. There's a whole school bus of kids that are on a field trip and they are possessed by Native American spirits led by Miskamakis and turn on their parents and do, you know, what you would expect in Devil Kid kind of movies. But it really didn't have the laughs. So that's what I'm looking for. It just wasn't that funny. But probably the best of the books. And then Masterton didn't want to be king. Like, he took a decade off and decided, I'm not going to write horror. I'm not going to write sex novels. I'm going to write, like, historical romance and detective fiction and other stuff. And didn't come back to the series until 1992 with the book Burial, in which Miskamakis is erasing all trace of European colonists and sending us all to his Native American hell. I don't know. That one was kind of forgettable. And then after 9/11, he just kept cranking them out. In Plague of the Manitou, there was actually the sons of Miskamakis who were actually shape-shifting nuns who spread pestilence through bedbugs.
Recommend right there. Shape-shifting nuns that are the child of a Manitou. There's bad enough to be good.
This needs to be a franchise. Blumhouse, get on this. Let's go.
This one was kind of crazy because their whole plot is to like get the bedbugs in hotels to infect people. And they bring in this exorcist, this guy, and he's like, I have to do this naked. And he ends up like doing this weird dance and they make him bite his dick off. Like, it, that one is super crazy, I will say, Plague of the Manitou. And then the finale is, there was a short story, really. It wasn't a novel. But Harry actually gets with Karen, and they have a kid. And so Miskamakis tries to, you know, possess her and turn it into the exorcist and bring the influence full circle and spirit jump. But none of them are really good. And none of them are really crazy except that Plague of the Manitou. Yeah, that was maybe the weirdest one of all of the sequels. But let's do some other kind of weirdness. March patrons, we're still thinking about you. Instead of Manitous floating around in space, how about some Dragon Balls? By special request.
Dragon Ball Super Broly? Brawly?
Broly, yeah. Doesn't that sound like surfer speak for like, hey, Brawly, you want to go watch some anime? Like some Japanese cartoon that makes no sense and then you have to watch 90 years of previous episodes to understand?
Someone's bitter about doing research.
We've been told that this is a film for everyone. And if you've never watched Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, or any of that 35-year-old franchise, then you are going to be able to appreciate the latest movie that came out 2 years ago. And that's what we're doing.
I know they did a live action one. Is this live action?
Nah, not the live action one. But guess who drew the short straw and is watching it all? I'm watching the live action and I'm watching what I can of all of the previous incarnations so that I can try to put it all in some context when we get there next month.
And I'm playing the video games.
Well, look at you.
So that will be coming next month. You can't say we don't keep our patron picks varied.
Mm.
But we know what's coming later down the year. It will continue to be varied from very beloved films to very unknown films. And somewhere in the middle falls Dragon Ball Super Broly.
It's what I most love about doing these patron shows, is that these are no way would they fit into our normal calendar, and yet they're all pretty special. I gotta say, everything that we've done is something that even if I didn't like, I feel like needed to be covered. They're unique, one-of-a-kind experiences that run the gamut between so bad it's good to so bad it's bad to true classics. We'll be getting all of that in the patron picks to come. I know, because we've had people already donate to tell us what we'll be watching, and it will be revealed in time.
So thank you for being an Outplaying patron. We hope you're enjoying the variety as much as we are, and thank you for supporting our show and allowing us to do the show we do every single Tuesday. Jacob, Stuart, thank you for joining me. And until next time, the show is dead, but the podcast lives on.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
I want you to know you're worth every penny.
Oh, you're too kind, too kind.
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
I just don't know how to tell you how much I appreciate everything you do. You do so much for me.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
I ought to see what those tarot cards have to say about us.
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
I will be here.
Yes, next week, same time, same place.
All right.
Goodbye.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
You mean you don't believe us?
Well, now, let's just say that I'm cautious.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
Love is one of the strongest medicines there is.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
Be a thief, be a lawyer, even if you must be a doctor, but whatever you do, don't be an administrator.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Oh, everybody stand back and I'll begin working.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2021, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
There. Reality.
Going to see Karen in her hospital room, John does what he can, but the Manitou spirit births a half-sized version of Miskamoskus.
I mean, ask any 6-year-old and they would come up with something better than Pana Witchy Solitu, but I love it.
Witchy, witchy, ay, ay, ay. Creole Lady Marmalade, right? I mean, that's where my mind goes.
You know what? It really should have been remixed into a disco song. I definitely think there's something there, but...